Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So you might not think it to look at me now, but when I was young, I tap danced. This is like a little, please don't ask me to tap dance at any talent shows or anything, but I will tell you. So for years, I had loved old movie musicals, and I wanted to be Fred Astaire. Not Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire. And I think I had this notion that all she did was twirl around, which I realize is a total disservice to Ginger Rogers and her talents. But for some reason, Fred Astaire's moves looked cooler to me. So I started taking tap dancing. And I would put, we lived in an apartment, and I would put down an old bookshelf piece on the floor and practice in this like tiny bookshelf space, hoping that I wasn't bothering the downstairs neighbors too much. The best part, although it was also by far the most nerve-wracking part, were the performances at the end of the year, right, when all the families come in and you do your dance. All the moves you'd been practicing all year alone and in class together, and then you're in this moment where everyone is looking at you. And there was this deep sense of being part of a larger whole. I think anyone who's danced a routine with others knows this sense, that when you dance, you're doing your own moves, but you're part of something. You're part of a bigger movement. And it looks different because there's 10 of you doing it instead of just one. And in those moments, moving my body as I'd been taught to, I felt connected to Fred Astaire and to all my fellow dancers in those moments. Through your body, there's this sense of being powerfully individual and yet one piece of a larger thing. One strong but small blip in the history of bodies dancing. Whenever I tell people about what Unitarian Universalism is, I break it down. I talk about the Unitarians, I talk about the Universalists, and that's what we're doing these 2 weeks, and we're starting with the Unitarians because that's what's in your name, the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood. I talk about the Unitarians and how they go all the way back to the time of Jesus, to a moment when there was no decisive understanding of who or what Jesus was. The Unitarians, who were called Arians back then, after a teacher named Arius, believed that there was a time when Jesus didn't exist. So this is a little bit of like theological stuff right here. The folks who ended up promoting the Trinity believed that Jesus and God were co-eternal, but the Arians, who were the Unitarians, believed in a single God that eventually created Jesus, who was not co-eternal. Okay? It's a little bit of a theological sticking point, but it eventually landed the Arians the brand of heretics. There was too much confusion. There was too much confusion for some, and so the many interpretations that existed in Christianity in its early days had to be pinned down to one thing, one single orthodoxy. And that ended up with the Nicene Creed, which maybe some of you recited as children on Sundays. Of course, though, heresies seldom actually fully die. And so Arianism continued to crop up again and again in various places. And then a form of it takes some shape much later during the Reformation in Transylvania, of all places. The Unitarians that came up in those centuries similarly believed that the Trinity was nowhere to be found in the scriptures, and that Jesus was a human being, divinely inspired, but human, and that there was only one God. They wanted to follow Jesus as an example, not treat him like a deity. Just a human whose ideas and actions and words changed the world. It was in those reforming decades, actually, that our one and only martyr lived. I don't know if any of you have heard. Some of you must have heard of him. Miguel Servetus. He wrote a treatise on Unitarianism, and because he then refused to recant his position that Jesus was not God, he was burned at the stake. This European Unitarianism continues to this day. Many American Unitarian churches have partnerships with Unitarian churches in Romania now. American Unitarianism came into prominence in the late 1700s, early 1800s. Congregational churches across New England argued about doctrine and dogma on this point of the nature of Jesus. Harvard Divinity School started to come under the influence of people who did not believe that Jesus was God, Unitarians, helping to spread that message. And in 1819, William Ellery Channing, who's a luminary of Unitarian history, delivered a sermon that helped to define what Unitarianism was in this country. It was a sermon that denied the notion of a three-in-one God, a sermon that called on people to use their reason and logic and experience, a sermon that affirmed that humanity was capable and competent and possessed of free will and the ability to make moral choices. Channing and the other Unitarians believed in a singular God as creator and parent, but also really as something we could only understand by understanding ourselves. Channing, like others of his time, focused much on the self, on the possibility inherent in the individual, offering less focus on the communal. Around Channing and the other Unitarians started to grow up this philosophical movement, the Transcendentalists, of whom Emerson was one. They came of age alongside Unitarianism, similarly valuing the individual and believing in an individual's ability to create and intuit. The Enlightenment ideals that they shared, ideals about human value and the importance of reason, are woven through our Unitarian past. Some of them, but not all of them, called for radical social reform. Some were strong in their belief that society and its institutions were corrupting the natural, powerful state of humanity. Others were so focused on the self that the outside didn't matter as much. The Transcendentalists influenced and were influenced by Unitarianism. Both were open to texts of world religions, in part because of this notion that human thought is so valuable. And so human thought, however it manifests, human understandings of truth and experience, however they manifest, were valuable to the Unitarians and the Transcendentalists. Over time, Unitarianism moved even deeper into its understanding that all of us experience the world and interpret the world in our own way, and can, using our human intuition, come to our own beliefs and understandings irrespective of dogma and doctrine. I share this incredibly brief history of Unitarianism, incredibly brief. Please don't think that you know it all now, because I think that sometimes we forget where we come from. Our religion, and I promise someday I will preach a whole sermon about why I refuse to stop calling it a religion. Our religion was not born at the merger of Unitarians and Universalists in 1961. Our religion was not born with Ken Patton and the strong growth of humanism, or with the counter-growth of more spiritual folks. It wasn't even born with Channing, who delivered that decisive sermon, or Emerson and all those other famous folks we love to talk about. There are roots and strands of Unitarianism that go back to the beginnings of what would become called Christianity. And from all those strands and those roots, there are lessons to be learned, wisdom to be gleaned, gifts to be cherished. The original Unitarians, those followers of Arius, held one of many beliefs about the nature of God and Jesus and the world until the Nicene Creed rendered them heretics. Their beliefs, which they held were entirely reasonable and indeed scriptural, had to be justified in the face of orthodoxy. In a sense, then, we can understand why early Unitarians were much more open to many interpretations and theologies. They had a long history of themselves being shut out. This openness evidenced itself later in that Transylvanian community during the Reformation, where we had our one and only Unitarian king, which is always exciting. There were religions tolerance laws on the books under that king during the Reformation. And every time these heresies of Arianism or Unitarianism cropped up across Europe after that Nicene Creed was determined, every time they had the courage to speak up, it was a spark of that same personal intuition that Emerson and Channing wrote about. It was someone using reason and logic in their own context to say, this doesn't seem right, this doesn't feel consistent, I cannot speak these words anymore, these affirmations, because they are not what I know to be true. Unitarianism was then almost by definition an affirmation of the individual's ability to create meaning, intuit truths, realize and integrate new thoughts. It was almost by definition an affirmation of free will and the capable mind. It was an affirmation of human value, of the value of a mind that remained open to the ways other minds needed to read or hear a message. There's an openness built into the DNA of Unitarianism. There's an affirmation of humanity built into the DNA of our Unitarianism. It's no wonder then that it's a pretty short trip from Unitarian Christianity to humanism and then to a broad and open theology. The understandings that developed from out of a belief in one God and a reasonable reading of Scripture were a belief in one humanity. Despite our different beliefs and different religious expressions, there was a notion of our shared humanness, that we all suffer the same griefs and fears, that we all celebrate the same joys, that we all long for love and belonging. That humanness, whether individual or collective, holds a power that the Unitarians and the Transcendentalists came to recognize. The passage we read from Emerson this morning lifts up this inherited Unitarian spirit, a spirit that affirms the individual and its power while also recognizing the larger communal whole. Emerson affirms hope for humanity over and over and speaks of what he calls the oversoul. It's a concept closely related to Vedic, which are early Hindu scriptures. It's closely related to Vedic understandings of a collective soul or a collective consciousness. He writes, "The supreme critic on the errors of the past and the present, and the only prophet of that which must be, is that great nature in which we rest as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere. That unity, that oversoul, within which every man's particular being is contained and made one with all the other, that common heart. Within man is the soul of the soul, the wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. Everything is in us, and we are in everything," Emerson wrote. "We are all one, one shared humanity. We are finite and infinite, a small particle of some larger whole, and yet individually also so unbelievably powerful." And this is where his hope piece comes in. If as individuals we are powerful, and if as a collective we are all that is powerful in that most grand sense, then we can change anything and everything. Everyone is part of that oversoul, that oneness, as he understands it. Everyone can have a transcendent experience, accessing unity and wholeness, which makes everyone a spiritual equal, which makes it necessary to provide everyone with the opportunity to connect to that oneness. Emerson himself wasn't a social reformer particularly, but many around him were, exactly because they felt it imperative to remove obstacles that prevented people from experiencing this transcendent connection to the oneness of all things. Although transcendentalism sort of lived up alongside Unitarianism, that idea of universal oneness became solidly pulled in to the Unitarian spirit. Those are the lessons, then, that we get when we look back. The power of human reason and intuition and logic. The value of speaking up when even when others view our view as a heresy. The wholeness of which we are just a small part, doing our moves as best we can in the larger dance. Our Unitarian past can, if we are willing to reflect on it, if we are willing to let it, give us the strength to be outliers in our radical welcome, because it is an uncommon thing to be able to sit side by side with someone whose theology is so different from your own and yet be committed to the same faith, to the same goals. It can give us the strength to be individuals who know the power of community. Strength to work for a broader world that holds space for all people. Our Unitarian past cannot be rejected or put aside. We have to understand it and integrate it, and let us hear its power as we learn the lessons that it teaches.